Beruchim Abayim, ladies. Bezrat Hashem, we are going to begin our summer schedule where we will be delivering our weekly Parashah Shi'ur for ladies in Ohel Yaakov Synagogue on Lawrence Avenue, God willing, at 11:30 a.m. Bezrat Hashem, I'll try to keep the Shi'ur prompt where we can begin on time and end on time. I don't know exactly what ending on time means, but whatever that means, we'll end in a timely fashion. Our parashah this week is Parashat Korach. Parashat Korach is one of the more famous parashiyot that people are familiar with the story. And actually, it's one of the most tragic stories of our history in the Midbar. You know, for 40 years in the desert, there were a lot of ups and downs. It was like a roller coaster. We had a lot of good times and a lot of bad times. The episode of Korach is one of the darkest moments in our nation. Just to review the story quickly and then to make some insights. Korach, who was a member of the tribe of Levi, so that actually makes him, without getting into all the family, a first cousin of Moshe Rabbeinu. And Korach mustered together a group of people, including Datan v'Abiram, the famous Datan v'Abiram, the antagonists of Moshe way back in the times of Egypt. And they joined Korach, and he also got 250 rabbis, heads of the Sanhedrin, heads of the High Court, to also join him. To do what? They created a mutiny against Moshe Rabbeinu, meaning a revolution. They came to the conclusion that Moshe Rabbeinu is power hungry and that he appointed himself, self-proclaimed leader as the Jewish people. He appointed his brother Aharon to be the Kohen Gadol. So they claimed that he was a nepotist, that he puts his family in high positions. There was also an appointment of a fellow called Elitzafan ben Uziel. Moshe made him the president of the tribe of Levi. Korach had claims about that also. How come you made him the president of the tribe? How come you skipped over me? So Korach, if you can imagine such a thing, was questioning the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu. And he had backing, he had support. Not thousands of people, but he had enough support to make trouble. And at the end, we know the faith of Korach and all his followers. It says, the ground opened up and swallowed Korach, his family, his children, and all his supporters. Never in history did we ever see such a miraculous death. I mean, where the ground opens up and swallows, you know, an entire assembly of people. I mean, we're not talking about a sinkhole over here. This is, it's like the ground had a mouth to it and just devoured all Korach's people. So that's basically the story. There's a very interesting Ramban in the beginning of the Parashah. The Ramban asks, why did Korach wait until now to wage his machloket, to wage his dispute? The Ramban says, these appointments were made years before. So why was Korach so patient? Meaning the Ramban saying, Korach was percolating already for many years about this subject. He was stewing. He couldn't wait to fight against Moshe Rabbeinu, to attack him. So why did he wait until this week's parashah, until this given point in history, to wage his war? Why was he so patient? What was Korach waiting for? So the Ramban has a very, very interesting theory. He says he couldn't go after Moshe Rabbeinu because until this point, how shall I say it? Moshe Rabbeinu's approval ratings were very high. You know, leaders go through stages. Sometimes they're very popular, and other times, you know, the people are not so happy with them. For a large period throughout the Midbar, Moshe Rabbeinu's ratings were very high. After all, look what he was doing for them. He was providing for them man. They were getting breakfast, you know, served by their tent every morning. They had the clouds of glory protecting them. They had a well that was giving them fresh water every day. So basically the accommodations that Moshe Rabbeinu was providing them were beautiful. How could you complain against Moshe Rabbeinu? And any request that they have, Moshe Rabbeinu handles it. And even the Ramban says when they worship the Egel, when they worship the golden calf, relatively speaking, there were not that many casualties. The Torah says 3,000 people died. That's not bad. Out of the whole episode of Avodah Zarah, idolatry, 3,000 casualties. And then when God vowed to destroy the nation, who defended us? Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe got up and prayed to God for 40 days and 40 nights. And God eventually told the Jewish people, I forgive them. So the people said, wow, Moshe Rabbeinu is unbelievable. He got us off the hook with the Egel as well. We were destined to doom. And Moshe Rabbeinu prayed, and he exonerated us. So Moshe Rabbeinu was enjoying a crest of popularity. The Ramban says, if Korach would have went against Moshe Rabbeinu in those days, they would have stoned him. The people would not have tolerated somebody second guessing or questioning Moshe Rabbeinu's actions. So Korach was a smart man. He was a calculated man. He waited. He waited for the right time to attack in order that he'll be effective. When did he decide to fight Moshe? After last week's parasha. What happened in last week's parasha? The spies came back from Israel. The spies gave a malignant report about the land of Israel. They maligned Israel. The Jewish people accepted the report, and they started to cry, we don't want to go to Israel. We want to go back to Egypt. God got very upset at his people. And what did God say? Nobody's going into Israel. As a matter of fact, anybody that's living in the Midbar is going to die in the Midbar. And that's what ended up happening. Every Tisha B'Av, for the next 40 years in the Midbar, the Jewish people had to dig their graves on Tisha B'Av, and they would sleep in their graves that night. And then on the next day, Moshe Rabbeinu would say, let the living rise. Whoever was still alive got up and walked out. And whoever died stayed down. Of course, they buried them. And that's how the Jewish people lived after the Midaginim, after the spy story. And Moshe Rabbeinu did not protect them. Moshe didn't pray for them. Moshe Rabbeinu just accepted the faith. And at that point, the popularity of Moshe started to dwindle. The people started to have claims against Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe, why don't you handle this for us? We're in trouble. Get us back into Israel. Pray for us. Get us off the hook like you did for the Egel. Do something, Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do anything. Korach saw already Moshe's popularity started to dwindle. So what did Korach say? Now he's vulnerable. Now if I go after him, he's not going to get public support. Because the people are upset about him with the debacle of the spies. And therefore Korach was a master politician. He knew exactly when to find weakness in Moshe Rabbeinu's acceptance, and then he capitalized on it. And he cashed in on it. So therefore it was a calculated effect that Korach had. It was all done precisely at the right time. But the rabbis learn a great lesson from here. A lesson about human nature. The people were upset about Moshe Rabbeinu after what happened with the spies. Ladies, I ask you, who asked to send spies? Whose idea was it to send spies? Moshe Rabbeinu told the people, don't send spies. You don't need to send spies. God says the land is good. What are you sending spies for?
You know whose idea was it to send spies? The people's idea. The spies came back. Who gave the bad report? The spies. Moshe Rabbeinu told the people, don't believe them. Don't listen to them. But the people believed them anyway. And then the people started crying. Moshe Rabbeinu said, what are you crying for? The land is good. So listen to what happened. They sent the spies. They believed the bad report from the spies. They cried as a result of it, they don't want to go to Israel. And then when they get punished, whose fault is it? Moshe's fault. What did Moshe Rabbeinu do? How could you blame Moshe? You were guilty of everything, and then you point fingers and blame the whole thing on Moshe Rabbeinu? From here you see the nature of human beings. Human beings never want to take responsibility for their actions. A human being will always find a way to point the finger to somewhere else in order to blame all their problems on somebody else that's external from them. We live in a generation that, this is the hallmark of this generation, where nobody takes responsibility for their actions. You could have a serial murder, and in the courtroom his lawyer will say, what do you expect from him? In 8th grade he had a teacher that failed him on a test, and he was devastated, and he never recovered as a result of it, and all his friends passed, and he failed the test. Do you expect anything else from such a person than to go kill 30 people? And this has already become a mindset in the nation that it's never your fault. Anything human beings do, you can always blame it on somebody else. A therapist will tell a patient, it's not your fault, it's your mother's fault. Because when she was young, she didn't bring you up the right way. And therefore you're not held accountable in the way you're acting today. Or is your father's fault? Or is society's fault? Everybody in the world is guilty, except the person himself. And that's exactly what happened to Moshe Rabbeinu's time. They sent the spies. They believed them. They cried. And then you go ask them, how did you do this? How did we do it? Look at Moshe Rabbeinu. It was his fault. His fault? He didn't do anything. You hear about CEOs of companies that embezzle millions of dollars in their companies. As we're hearing today with different companies in the corporate America. And after they get indicted for embezzlement, they stand up very proudly and confidently in a press conference. And they get up and say, mistakes were made. What do you mean were made? By who? By an invisible person? Who's this invisible person that's always making mistakes? Instead of getting up and saying, Hatati, Aviti, Pashati, instead of coming along and confessing and saying, I am guilty, I committed sin, mistakes were made by some anonymous being that always makes mistakes. This is already a very important musar that the Torah is telling us. One of the major principles and tenets of Judaism is confession. How much emphasis do our rabbis and does the Torah place on confession? We have a whole day of Kippur. What's the whole day of Kippur based on? A person admitting his sins. If we were to let modern society give us a day of confession, the day of confession in the Vidui would be text. It would have a different wording to it. It would have a different text to it. And what would it say? God forgive my father. God forgive my mother. God forgive society. God forgive my friends. God forgive my teacher. Because it's their fault and I'm innocent. Hat'u, pash'u, avu. But our religion says, Hatati, I have sinned. I have committed iniquity. And that's a very important lesson. But a person has to be held accountable for his own actions. Of course we're all influenced by society. And of course there are a lot of external things that play a role in how we act. But ultimately we have free will. Nobody can cause a human being to act the way he acts. Ultimately a person is able to overcome his weaknesses and control himself. To blame it on others is only an escape in order to escape accountability. And that's what happened in the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. They were guilty on all accounts. And they pointed fingers. Moshe, you're no leader. If you're a true leader, you would have saved us from the sin of the spies. Moshe Rabbeinu saw the people, Korach saw the people murmuring. He said, ah, now's a perfect time to go against Moshe Rabbeinu. Now already the public opinion is swaying, and therefore he felt that it'd be successful. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. You must know this Mishnah. The Mishnah there says the following. There's two types of disputes. In Hebrew, the word for dispute is mahloket. The two disputes fall into two distinct categories. There's a mahloket that's called mahloket l'shem shamayim, and then there's another mahloket shelo l'shem shamayim. There's a mahloket that the disputants are fighting for the sake of heaven. And then you have a different type of mahloket where it's not an idealistic argument. It's not for the right intentions. It's not l'shem shamayim. It's not for the sake of heaven. But it's personal. It's because they have an agenda. It's because of honor. So the Gemara, the Mishnah, gives us two classical examples of each type of mahloket. A mahloket l'shem shamayim, Hillel v'Shamay. Hillel and Shammai were two rabbis. Two great Tanaim. Their names are mentioned on almost every page of the Talmud. And Hillel and Shammai, the schools of Hillel and Shammai, they always argued with each other. The school of Hillel was usually more lenient, and the school of Shammai was usually more strict. But the Mishnah says, even though they always were fighting with each other in halakha, and they were always arguing on each other, Bet Hillel said yes, Bet Shammai says no. Bet Shammai says yes, Bet Hillel says no, Bet Shammai says yes. But they didn't see eye to eye on most issues. Always in the Bet Midrash, Hillel's on one side, Shammai's on the other side. But the Mishnah says it was a good mahloket. You know why? Because they were l'shem shamayim. They were purely motivated. Their intention was not to fight with each other. Their intention was to get to the truth. What does God want? How does God want us to serve Him? Is this way or that way? So Shammai held this way, and they held that way. But it wasn't personal. And what's the proof that it wasn't personal, and it wasn't a rivalry? Because the Gemara says that the two schools of Shammai and Hillel, they intermarried within each other, despite their differences. Would you, do you think a student of Shammai would marry into Hillel's family? Those two schools were arguing, they were diametrically opposed in philosophy. But outside the Beit Midrash, outside of the argument, they were friends. They were tolerable to each other. Shammai married Hillel, Hillel married Shammai. The schools got along. It's Mahlok and Hashem Shammai. It was purely motivated only how to serve God. It wasn't a personal attack on each other. Good, that's the example of Mahloket L'Shem Shamayim. What's the case of a Mahloket Shelo L'Shem Shamayim? The Mishnah says, Korach V'Adato. Korach and his group. That's the classical case of a Mahloket for the wrong intentions. For kavod, for glory, to elevate yourself, to become a superior. But the rabbis all ask on this Mishnah. I understand the mahloket of Hillel and Shammai. You gave me two sides. Hillel was on one side, Shammai is on the other side. But when you discuss the bad type of mahloket, the Mishnah says, who typifies that mahloket? Korach va'adato. It should say, Korach against Moshe. Aren't those the two sides of that mahloket? The Mishnah only gives me one side. The mahloket shelo l'shem shamayim is who Korach and his people. It verses, but it doesn't tell us verses. It just tells us Korach and his people. That's not a mahloket. It's one side. You should tell me Korach versus Moshe. That was a mahloket that was based on the wrong intentions. Why does the Mishnah only give me Korach's side of it? So I heard two explanations that are very important. The first explanation is like this. When you see a group of people that are coming to argue, let's say they're coming to argue against the rabbi, like in this case. there a way to tell if they're l'shem shamayim or not? How could you tell if they're purely motivated? Of course, if you ask them, they'll say, oh, we're l'shem shamayim. Everybody's l'shem shamayim. You know, the Arabs kill l'shem shamayim also. So you can't ask them if they're l'shem shamayim. Everybody thinks that they're purely motivated. How do we know? How are we supposed to know if a person is purely motivated, if a group is purely motivated? So you know what one of the litmus tests is? See if the group themselves are getting along with each other. If the group themselves is harmonious, and there's friendship amongst them, and there's unity amongst the group, then you could assume that they are idealistically purely motivated. But if in the group itself that's coming against the rabbi, they themselves are fighting with themselves, and there's politics within the group themselves, and there's infighting amongst them, then already you see they're not purely motivated, because each one has their own agenda. This one's fighting the rabbi because he wants to be the president. This one's fighting the rabbi because the rabbi didn't go to his wedding. This guy's fighting the rabbi because he had a family dispute with him. Each guy's fighting for a different reason, and a lot of times the reasons contradict each other, but they just have one common denominator. We don't like the rabbi, but they don't like each other either. Then already you're not l'shem shamayim. Korach and his group, you know how you know they weren't l'shem shamayim? Because each guy was fighting Moshe with a different agenda. Korach's fighting, he wants to be the Kohen. Datan v'Aviram are fighting, because that was old history. They're taking revenge against Moshe Rabbeinu from the days in Egypt. When Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Egyptian, and Datan v'Aviram squealed on him, and that whole story. So there was always politics between Datan v'Aviram and Moshe. So this was their chance to take revenge. Different goals than Korach. The tribe of Reuven also joined. You know why they joined? They said, hey, we're the firstborn. Reuven's the firstborn. Levi, you're the thirdborn. Why should you be the leader? We're the leader. So they came for leadership. So Reuven's actually fighting Korach. Because Korach's claiming he wants to be the leader. But the tribe of Reuven's saying, no, we want to be the leader. So you see, even amongst the group themselves, they were fighting. That's what the Mishnah says. You know, they were not l'shem shamayim. It was Korach v'adato. The fight wasn't against Korach, against Moshe. It was Korach against his people. That's already the machloket. They were fighting amongst themselves. That's how you know they weren't l'shem shamayim. There was no unity in the group. And we see this many times, where factions come up and fight with each other, and then you start analyzing the faction on its own, and you see they themselves are disputing and fighting each other behind closed doors. This is not l'shem shamayim. In the school of Hillel, in the school of Shammai, everybody was on the same page. Everybody had one goal. L'shem shamayim, to understand the truth of God. We're not doing it for any other reason but that. Hence there was unity in the schools. Hence it was l'shem shamayim. But I heard another explanation from Rav Shimon Schwab, Zichron Lebracha. Very, very sharp insight. He says there's another way of telling if a dispute is l'shem shamayim or not. And that is, if the disputants hear each other's arguments. You're allowed to argue with somebody. You're allowed to have a different opinion. And you don't have to agree with everybody. You're allowed to be resolute on your opinion. Just because somebody has a different opinion doesn't mean you have to say, okay, I agree with you. But what? If you're truly, purely motivated, you'll hear what they're saying at least. Which means, I know what I say. I heard what you said. I digested it. I swallowed it. I analyzed it. I hear your proofs. But still, I reserve the right to argue with you because of this and this reason. At least you're l'shem shamayim because you hear what the other guy's saying. That was the machloket of Hillel and Shammai. They heard each other what they were talking. When they were talking to each other, they were listening. What are you saying? How do I know they were listening to each other? Because it says in the Gemara in Pesachim, when Hillel would get up in front of his students and discuss Torah, he would say, boys, let me first explain to you what our rivals say. He would explain to them Shammai's opinion first. Only after he would explain Shammai's opinion to the students, he would say, but we hold like this. What does that show you? Hillel understood what Shammai was saying. He respected him, he heard him, he understood there's another side over here. Oh, you're l'shem shamayim. If you're looking for the truth, then you'll hear somebody else's opinion. If you're looking to win, so you don't want to hear anybody else's opinion. If you're just looking for glory, when the guy on the other side of the table starts arguing, you put your ears on you put your hands on your ears and you start humming, you don't want to hear what they have to say. That's L'Shem Shamayim. Maybe he has something to say, maybe it's right. No, I want to win. Korah, the Mishnah is hinting to us, did not hear Moshe Rabbeinu. And you know how it's hinting to us? It says, Ezri Mahloket Shelo L'Shem Shamayim, Korah Va'adato. Period. Versus who? Versus nobody. In Korah's mind, there was nobody against him. In Korah's mind, there was nobody on the other side of the table arguing with him. He didn't hear Moshe's claims. Moshe Rabbeinu was screaming, Korah, you're crazy. What are you doing? You're out of your mind. Korah, did you hear that? I heard nothing. It's one-sided argument over here. I'm right, I don't hear anybody else. How could you be the Shem Shamayim? Korah, listen to what Moshe has to say. Digest it. Sleep on it. Analyze it. But the mahlokah of Korah is what? Korah va'adato. To them, there was nobody else. Moshe didn't exist in the argument. And therefore, it's Shalom Hashem Shamayim. Our rabbis tell us a statement in the Talmud. Keshem sheparzufehem shel adam enam domot ze lazeh, kach de'otehem enam shavot ze lazeh. Just like no two people look alike, no two people think alike. Even identical twins are not purely identical. Nobody looks exactly like their friend. So the Gemara says, that's the nature of people. Just like there's diversity in the way people look, so there's diversity in the way people think. No two people think alike. So I once heard an explanation from Rav Shlomo Eger. He says, what did you need this whole example? Just like no two people look alike, they don't think alike. Just say, no two people think alike. What do you have to give me an example about the way people look? So he said like this. When you see somebody that doesn't look like you, do you get angry at him? Do you get upset? He said, no, okay, doesn't look like me. That's his problem. It's not good, it's not bad. It doesn't bother you. You don't know, no one gets, which is we all have tolerance to somebody else's looks. So the Gemara is telling you, just like you tolerate somebody else's looks and it doesn't bother you, you should be able to be not so close-minded that you could tolerate that somebody has a different opinion than you as well. It shouldn't bother you the way he thinks different than you, than the way he looks different than you. Just like you're not bothered the way he looks different, it shouldn't bother you the way he thinks differently. But that talks about tolerance. Now again, don't misunderstand me. This doesn't mean you have to agree with everybody. You're allowed to have an opinion, you're allowed to have a resolute opinion. But the Torah says at least you have to hear the other side. The judges in the Jewish courtroom always have to hear both sides. They're not allowed to give a ruling if they hear one side. And they have to understand the defense, and they have to understand the offense. Both sides have to be clear. Then you can make a judgment. I want to point out, ladies, we're not talking about over here sides that are outside the realm of Torah. You shouldn't confuse it. If some reform or conservative rabbi would come in and say, I have an opinion, we're not interested in listening to your opinion. Already we have no tolerance to even hear a side. It's not a side, it doesn't exist. But I just want to give an interpretation. Out, next, doesn't start. You're off the charts. We're only talking in Torah Judaism, where there's different approaches, where there's different shitot. You have the Hasidim think one way, you have the Lithuanian think one way, Ashkenazim a different way, but it's in the framework of religion. Then already there's room for a different approach, a different idea, a different hashkafa. But if it's coming from someone that's out of the framework of religion, of pure, authentic Torah Judaism, there is no tolerance for such a thought. Then, on the opposite, just like he looks different than you, or upset the way he looks at looks as well, and so too the way he thinks. And that was Korah's problem. He didn't hear Moshe Rabbeinu. To him it was a one-sided argument. It was Korah Va'adato, period. The Malbim on our parasha asks a question. The Malbim says, what made this episode of Korach more severe than all the other episodes in the Torah? Why do I say it's more severe? Moshe Rabbeinu, when the Jewish people worshipped the Egel, he prayed for the people. Please God, give them a second chance. And most of the cases when the Jewish people were disobedient, it was Moshe Rabbeinu that defended them in the eyes of God. You know what Moshe Rabbeinu did in this case? Please God, kill them miserably. He even says, not a regular death. Let them die an unnatural death that never happened in the history. Let the ground open up. It's very un-Moshe-like. Moshe, what are you getting all excited? Okay, so they're disobedient again. So I add it to the list. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu become so unraveled when he comes to God and says, kill them, destroy them? How come Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say, all right, God, listen, give them a bye, you know, it's another mistake, kapara, you know, they don't know what they're doing. The Malbim says, what made this mahloket, this rebellion, more severe? So he says an amazing thing. He says, Korach's rebellion struck at the very heart of the nation's faith. Why? I'll explain it to you. Ladies, we are still observant to our Torah that was given 3,000 years ago. What is our faith based on? If somebody will come and ask you, you follow the Torah, why? You'll say, who said? On whose word? So I don't know, my mother taught me, my father taught me. Then who taught them? My grandfather. What, so you're basing it on like tradition from your family? That's the whole thing? They say, no. It's not so, because if you trace it all the way back, there were eyewitnesses. Listen to what I'm telling you. There was eyewitnesses that saw with their own eyes Moshe Rabbeinu come down from the mountain or to the mountain and give the Torah to Israel. It was one of the most miraculous days in history, Matan Torah. How many people were standing at Har Sinai? Over 3 million Jews witnessed the giving of the Torah to the Jewish people. They were all standing there. No, it was undeniable. It was unimpeachable. All the people saw that God designated Moshe and gave the Torah. So our religion is very firmly established. We had 3 million eyewitnesses to prove the veracity of our religion. By the way, in a court today, how many witnesses do you need to prove something? 2 witnesses. We have 3 million witnesses. I don't think there was an event in history, I'm talking the history of any nation, that had an event that had so many eyewitnesses to it. Think about it. 3 million people, to get them together to witness something? Think of all the other religions, ladies. Take Christianity, for example. You'll forgive me, in front of a Sefer Torah. What is it based on? How many witnesses? One man. One man that said that he had a prophecy, that God came to him in a dream, and said the Jewish people are not the chosen people anymore. Now we are the chosen people. The whole religion is based on one man. I ask you a question. Who has stronger proof? We have 3 million witnesses. They have one man on his own word. Islam, the Muslims, what do they base their religion on? How many witnesses? One man. Muhammad woke up one morning and he said, I had a dream. What was the dream of Muhammad? They came to me and they said, the Jews are no longer the people. It's us. Oh, so now already Muhammad and Christianity are arguing on what testimony did he accept? I mean, the Christians came along and said, what do you mean? We had a dream. Muhammad said, I also had a dream. We say, you're still dreaming. We had 3 million witnesses. Who has a bigger proof? 3 million people saw it. We're going to base the whole religion on one guy who had a dream, who had a nightmare. And therefore, that's very key to remember that. Our religion is firmly established because of Har Sinai. Korach came along now. And what did Korach say? Korach came along and said, Moshe, I don't deny you. You gave the Torah to the Jewish people. You're the guy. You're the prophet. All Korach came was with what? You appointed Aharon on your own. Technically, it was a small claim. He was just saying, you did this on your own. You know what Moshe Rabbeinu was concerned about? If he lets Korach get away with that, you know what's going to happen in the future generations? The people might say, if Moshe Rabbeinu already was suspected for making appointments on his own, maybe he gave the Torah on his own also. It'll cast aspersions and doubt on Matan Torah. Because if Moshe Rabbeinu can do this without the approval of God, appointing Aharon, Elitzafan, whatever he was doing, then already people might say, yeah, Moshe Rabbeinu was a controversial figure. You see Korah, there was issues with him. He wasn't so glot. You know, he wasn't so straight. And then already they might come along and say, who says even, you know, maybe the Torah he gave us was his own book. Maybe already, you know, it was his own conjecture. And what happens if that happens, ladies? Judaism is finished. If there's a little doubt on the veracity of Moshe Rabbeinu, that jeopardizes Torah min HaShamayim. That jeopardizes Torah min Sinai. Moshe Rabbeinu said, if Korah doesn't get punished in the most miraculous way, the people will always second guess our Torah's purity from heaven. And therefore, just like Matan Torah had to be given with miracles, Korach needed to be squashed with miracles so nobody can doubt that Moshe Rabbeinu never did anything on his own. And if he didn't appoint his brother on his own, then by extension, he must have not given the Torah on his own. Moshe Rabbeinu only acted according to what God told him. So you know why Moshe Rabbeinu overreacted, says the Malbim? He was preserving Torah for the future generations. Because if Korach can get away with this, the people will say, ah, Moshe Rabbeinu, the faith is insecure. And then Am Yisrael will be in jeopardy of losing its faith in Torah min Sinai, Torah min HaShamayim. Hence it was vital for Moshe Rabbeinu to squash Korach. And you know what? 3 million people saw Korach get swallowed under the ground. The same 3 million, minus Korach's family, obviously. 3 million minus 250. They witnessed Korach go down. That was the second Matan Torah. That was the second reconfirmation that God and Moshe Rabbeinu is his servant and Moshe only does things according to God's will. And it needed to be done with the drama of Matan Torah. Because that's what would have happened. You see over here a very important lesson. Actions that are done in one generation, the leaders are so smart. Moshe Rabbeinu says, if they get away with this, what's going to happen 1,000 years from now? At the time, you might have said, big deal, Moshe, what are you overreacting? So he says, you appointed Aharon. Okay, let him think that. What do you care? Let him think that. What's the big deal? You know you didn't appoint Aharon. You know it was God that appointed Aharon. You know that you didn't make yourself the self-proclaimed leader. Let him say what he wants. But Moshe knew, he was so smart. Moshe said, if this gets out, and people will think even, that I did things on my own, in 1,000 years, you'll have conservative and reform walking around saying, yeah, just like he appointed his brother, where you see Moshe was controversial, yeah, he gave the Torah on his own also. It's a fabrication of man. The Torah is made in China. The Torah is synthetic. Oh, and that's all we need. For people to second guess the veracity of Moshe. That's how we have to be so careful, ladies. When our great Hachamim make takanot, when our rabbis make certain decrees, when they made certain fences, we have to be so careful not to break any of their fences. Because if we break one of their fences, already now, what stops the next generation to break another one of their fences? If the rabbinate is not sacred and not holy, so then already, what stops the next generation going a step further? Moshe Rabbeinu said, maybe now it's not so serious, but if we let this guy get away with it, what's going to happen next? A simple example that we could probably relate to in our community would be our great rabbi. The former chief rabbi of our community, Hakam Yaakov Katzin, Zichron Lebracha, left us a tremendous legacy of greatness that he accomplished at the foundations of our community here in New York and New Jersey. It was he that laid the foundations that the later rabbis were able to produce what we're seeing here today. But he planted the seeds. We'll all agree to that. And in his genius, and it was actually a stroke of prophecy, he made a takana against accepting conversions in our community. How smart was that takana? He saw already the dangers of accepting conversions because they might be for the wrong reasons. It might only be for the intention to marry, and then it's going to dilute the whole genealogy of the community. We're not going to know who our families are. The family's going to be tainted. We're not going to know who's authentic and who's not, who's real, who's fake, who's counterfeit. Yes, ladies, the Torah does accept converts. However, the rabbi didn't go against the Torah law. He said, for our community, we cannot. If they want to convert, go convert. But just don't live with us. Just don't pray in our synagogue. But convert, but not just don't do it here. And for 50 or 60 years, our community has broken all records compared to other communities. I visited in Mexico and in Canada and in other countries throughout the world where they have Sephardi communities, and they're all tainted, unfortunately. Because this takana was not upheld by them, so there's confusion. Every time there's a marriage, you have to find out who's the father, the mother, or the father married a convert, who was the convert, who converted, was it legit, no, it wasn't legit. It's all a mess. There's no purity in the genealogy. 50 years later, look at our community. It's still a takana that's being upheld with all its strictness. Would you imagine, or can you imagine, if somebody would dare come today and say, we're going to break that takana of the rabbi? You'd say, impossible, how could you break a takana? But let's say we already set a precedence that we broke a takana already of the rabbi. Let's say if Rabbi Kasson said many years ago, that in Brooklyn, for example, it was his opinion that you shouldn't put an Eruv in Brooklyn. That was Rabbi Kasson's opinion. He didn't voice it. He wrote it in a letter. So that's a very, very scary precedence that we disregarded the rabbi's opinion on that. Who says now, in the future generations, that you'll say, well, you see, already this opinion wasn't held. So now already, maybe the conversions also we can do away with. You see how smart the rabbis were? You can't, once Hachamim make that kanot, you can't just say, well, this we're not going to take. You have to think of the consequences. You have to think of the future. What happened? Moshe Rabbeinu said, if I let Korah get away with this, seemingly it's not so bad now. But in 1,000 years they're going to say, just like Moshe appointed Aharon, Moshe gave the Torah on his own. Torah's not from heaven. Oh, you're going to deny Sinai? You deny Sinai, we have no religion. That's how careful we have to be to make sure that the enactments of the Hakamim, we cannot just come flippantly and say, nah, he would have changed his mind, no. Now already, it's not sacred anymore. Now already, you took away the sacredness of the Hakam. Now already we're vulnerable. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year. But if already you could break the word once, you could break it twice. If the word is unbreakable, then it's unbreakable. But already, we changed. Once you can change twice. And always the second change is usually much worse than the first one. It usually progressively gets worse and worse. That's the loyalty that we must have to the words of Hazan. Last but not least, the Torah tells us the story of, actually it's not the Torah, it's actually the Gemara, tells us the story of two very important ladies that were very influential in this week's Parasha. The wife of Korach, Mrs. Korach, and the wife of another member of Korach's group. That fellow's name was Mr. On Ben Pelet. His wife, Mrs. On Ben Pelet. We don't know their first names. What was so special about these wives? The Gemara actually says they were the cause behind their husband's decisions. What happened? Korach came home one day from the yeshiva where he learned with Moshe Rabbeinu, and his wife was working on him. Korach, what's going to be with you? Your cousin Moshe Rabbeinu is the president, he's the leader, he put his brother Kohen, he appointed the other cousin Elitzafan president of the tribe. What's going to be with you, Korach? You're a loser. You're letting him step on you. What did Korach probably tell his wife the first day? Come on, Chas v'Shalom, how could you talk like that? Moshe Rabbeinu, be quiet, don't talk, you're talking against the leader of Am Yisrael, the greatest prophet. The next day, Korach, what's going to be with you? She worked on him. Then one day it says, Moshe Rabbeinu took all the Levim, because God said, and all the Levim had to shave their hair. They were not allowed to have any hair on their body. So Korach comes home, and he's bald now. What does his wife say? What happened to you? Where's all your hair? So what do you mean? Moshe Rabbeinu did this to us. What? Moshe Rabbeinu did this? See, I told you. He wants you to look like a pumpkin, so he looks handsome and he'll be the leader. And he shaved them. So Korach says, what are you talking about? He even shaved his own children. His children are the Levim. He says, yeah, what does he care about his children? If he could shave your head, he'll shave his children also. Just to get you. Wow. So months of working on him. Working on him. Finally, she succeeded. So the Gemara tells us the downfall of Korach really was his wife. Shlomo HaMelech says it in Tehillim, Ve'ivelet b'yadeh tarsena. A bad wife brings down the husband. Instead of talking him out of it, she only fueled him. She only instigated him. And then when Korach finally lost resistance, and his wife was, you know, behind him, pushing him. So what ended up happening? The end of Korach we know. Both him and his wife and his children, actually his children got saved, but him and his wife suffered their fate. Who was On Ben Pelet? On Ben Pelet was also on the side of Korach. And he came home one day and his wife said, "No, what happened today? What's the politics?" He says, "Oh, we have good politics today. We have a group with Korach and a couple of the rabbis. And tomorrow morning we're going to wage war against Moshe Rabbeinu. We're going to show him. We're going to tell him. Who does he think he is?" So On Ben Pelet's wife says, "On, what are you talking about? What are you out of your mind? What do you have to gain over here?" He says, "What do you mean? We're going to get rid of Moshe Rabbeinu. And what are they going to do to you? If they get rid of Moshe, who's going to be the leader?" He says, "Korach." He says, "So what are you fighting in Mahlokah that you have nothing to gain for? If Korach wins, you're still nothing. If Moshe Rabbeinu wins, you're still on Ben Pelet. So what are you getting involved? You're fighting Korach's battles?" So all of a sudden, like, it made sense to him. He said, hey, what am I getting involved with? I'm like, Korach's using me. That's what she was saying. You're being used. What are you letting Korach use you so he can promote himself? But On said, yeah, but the boys are coming tomorrow. They're picking me up. On Ben Pellet says, he has the pressure. You know, I gave them my word. I can't cop out now. We're going to say, you know, I don't want to show up. They're going to say, oh, you're a wimp. You didn't show up. You gave us your word. So his wife says, I'll handle it. I'll get you out of it. You just go to sleep. She gave him some wine or something, got him drunk. He fell asleep. The next morning, the gang comes. You know, all Korach and his guide, they're coming to pick up On. He's a key player. Mrs. On Ben Pellet sits in front of her tent and she takes off her wig. The ladies in the olden days, even today, they cover their hair. She was a religious lady, On Ben Pellet's wife. What does she do? She takes off her hair covering. Now she's sitting there. These guys come. All of a sudden they see On Ben Pellet's wife without a hair covering. They say, we can't look at a lady without a hair covering. And these guys are a little schizophrenic, but they're fighting against Moshe Rabbeinu, but they can't look at a lady without a hair covering. So I have to figure out the psychology behind these people, but that's what happened. They saw On Ben Pellet's wife without the hair covering. They said, we got to kiss. Leave him. Forget about him. We got to go. Who saved On Ben Pellet from getting involved? His wife. His wife talked him out of it. And she put on this whole scheme in order to get them to leave him alone. On this Shlomo HaMelech says, Chokhmat Nashim Banta Beta. The wisdom of a righteous lady builds a home. And that's a very important lesson. It's a tale of two wives. Look at the impact that a Jewish wife has on her family. Ladies, you have this power. The advice, the guidance, the opinion that a wife has to a husband can either build a husband up and make him successful. However, Chas v'Shalom, if a lady does not stand in the right position and gives the wrong advice to her husband and takes the wrong side and instigates and creates the husband to be jealous and more competitive. You're nothing. You're not making enough money. You don't have any success. Now what are you causing the husband to do? To steal, to thief, and then the husband ends up in jail. Or the husband ends up with a heart attack, God forbid. And who instigated in some of the cases? The wife was instigating the husband. And therefore it's a very great responsibility. Am Yisrael, if they're successful, it's because of Chokhmat Nashim. On Ben Pellet remains alive because he had an Eshet Hayil. And Korach, unfortunately, the opposite. That should be a great motivation to all of you ladies to see to it, and it's in your ability that your husband succeed. When a husband comes home and says the wrong things, it's the wife of the husband, wife to say, it's the job of the wife to say, that shouldn't bother you so much. Don't worry. Don't be concerned about that. To put the husband back on the right track. Instead of saying, you're right, kill him, destroy him. That's what the Torah says, Ezer Kenegdo. That a wife is called an Ezer, an aid, Kenegdo against him. So the rabbis say it's a contradictory terminology. How can an aid be against you? Because sometimes the wife is an aid to her husband by being against him. By saying, don't let it rally up. If Korach came home and said, that Moshe Rabbeinu, he's a troublemaker, Mrs. Korach should have said, nah, come on, how do you say that? Don't talk like that. Instead, she said, you're right, look, he shaved your bald. He's no good. And therefore, Korach met his miserable fate. And that's the lesson of Chokhmat Nashim Banta Beta, the Ivelet Biyadeha Tarsena. Shabbat Shalom and Barakah.